On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Imagine, if you will, the site of your local town or city hall being engulfed by flames in widespread looting. And then imagine that the firefighters who are called upon to try and put out that fire have their hoses cut to shreds. And then imagine that the firefighters themselves actually are shot at, that they're literally fired on. This isn't a modern day scene that we're describing, but they are the events that happened in Cork City a century ago this week. The burning of Cork took place overnight on the 11th and 12th of December 1920. And it's what one historian has already termed the arson capital of Europe in 1920 because of how much violence there was in Munster's largest city. But there was, of course, this escalating series of outrages that culminated in much of the city being burnt to the ground. But did the world care, or had the Irish crisis already spiralled so much that no one else was shocked anymore? Well, Donal Fallon is on the line to tell us all about it. Donal, good afternoon. How are you?
It's good to be here. I often get abuse from Corkonians who say we don't cover Cork enough on the slot. So, I mean, this is a big week in the decade of centenaries for Cork. So we've arrived.
Let them feel that they are attended. Although I suppose what's remarkable already is that, you know, with there being so many centenaries that we've already discussed on this lot over the year, that honestly this one wasn't even on my radar at all, because I think it was just such a chaotic year that it's far too easy to overlook. By the time the Cork was burnt, the fire was already a fairly well-established weapon of war in Ireland, wasn't it?
It was, and the great Cork Fire Brigade historian Pat Poland, he came up with that line that, you know, that Cork was the arson capital of Europe in describing the great city in that year of 1920. And, you know, fire is a utilised weapon of war by both sides in the Irish Revolution. And in fact, the last great spectacular of the war was yet to come, which was the burning of Dublin's Custom House in the summer of 1921. But throughout 1919 and 1920, both sides are kind of using fire. The IRA had kind of systematically burnt RIC barracks across the country, and income tax offices that must have been fairly popular, you would imagine, you know, right across the island of Ireland. But, you know, in most cases, you burn an income tax office or you burn an RIC barracks after it's been abandoned, you know, and burning them kind of offered this powerful kind of propaganda image of an Ireland that Britain could no longer govern. What happened in Cork was something different entirely. This was an attack, if you will, on the commercial heart of an Irish city.
I'm sure we've mentioned in passing before, by the way, but the burning of the Custom House by the IRA in 1921, allegedly the brigade that did that included several predecessors or several ascendants of the current Minister for Housing, Dara O'Brien, who now runs a government department from that building, which I always love. Is just a poetry of how things come full circle. You mentioned, though, the scale of the destruction in Cork, above and beyond really anything that had been seen before, even though fire was a well-established weapon.
Absolutely. I mean, from the Carnegie Library to City Hall, from, you know, department stores to workplaces, a really significant part of Cork's kind of beautiful, kind of red brick inner city is destroyed by flames. And the Irish Times, you know, which is very much the unionist paper of the day, says that it's all valuable property, embracing some of the most flourishing establishments in the province of Ulster. And for me, you know, walking certain streets in Cork today, it recalls kind of walking the beautiful town centres of Europe, you know, destroyed in aerial bombardment during the war. And you can kind of see the new and the replaced amidst the historic. But, like, generally speaking, while fire had been, you know, happening for a long, long time, generally speaking, you could always predict what would be burnt in a reprisal. You know, the local creamery would be burnt. The Transport General Workers Union Hall would be burnt. And sometimes they'd burn things like temperance halls because they claimed that they were being used by Sinn Féin or the IRA. But, you know, what happens in Cork, it's on an unprecedented scale, and it's really a massive escalation in terms of the use of arson in the war.
Part of the reason why those of us who aren't from Leaside would be prepared almost to overlook, or that we might have forgotten this from our collective memories, is, I suppose, because, and we've already talked about some of the figures in this, that Cork's situation had been worsening politically and militarily for quite a while before this.
Absolutely. I mean, one Lord Mayor, Tomás McCurtain, had been gunned down in his home in front of his family. His successor, McSweeney, dies on hunger strike in Brixton Prison. That's a very prolonged hunger strike. It really grabs the attention of the world. And then the subsequent Lord Mayor is basically a Lord Mayor in exile. You know, he has to kind of flee. So significantly, I think the city and the politics of the city is one thing. But then the surrounding countryside of Cork was becoming the epicentre, really, of this very capable guerrilla campaign. And there was no disputing it, I think. You know, the British were really shaken by what was happening in Cork in late November, early December 1920. The Kilmichael ambush, where a First World War veteran, you know, Tom Barry, who was in modern-day Iraq in 1916 as a British soldier, inflicts, like, serious fatalities on the Oxies at Kilmichael. So the Oxies, what are they? They're officer veterans of the war. They're meant to be the creme de la creme, if you will, of the British Army. And now their Crossley tenders are just lying in a destroyed heap on a West Cork roadside. They've been beaten, and they knew they'd been beaten militarily. Mm. So the atmosphere in Cork, if you will, politically and militarily, is changing. And there's a real negative feeling, I think, among the Uggsies on the ground there.
Of course, and the centenary of Kilmichael remarked upon on Twitter this time last week, but we'll leave that one lie because we've had enough of that on the show already today. In London, things are slightly more familiar with our own time, or things which will look more familiar to modern listeners were already happening in response, particularly when it comes to Downing Street.
There's this incredible moment on Downing Street, which for, you know, for the British press is a moment of great humiliation and embarrassment. The psychological effect of the losses in Kilmichael. For the first time ever, barriers are erected at either end of London's Downing Street to protect it from IRA attack. And that's the kind of thing we're more used to seeing on the TV news today. You know, the House of Parliament, they closed the visitors gallery. Mm. So, you know, imagine the impact of that, the feeling that British democracy has to be done behind closed doors. And remember, the Prime Minister, Lloyd George, had christened the IRA the murder gang. But now they were kind of acknowledging, you know, at least, you know, privately in some ways and publicly in others, that they were up against a very capable kind of insurgency. And I mean, you could cut the atmosphere in Cork City at that moment in time with a knife. The city's under a very intense curfew from 10 p.m. nightly. And Dublin's also under a curfew. But, you know, Dublin's a much bigger city. I think Cork, there's not as many nooks and crannies to hide in. There's not as many ways to get around, if you will, the curfew, and it just feels much more suffocating. Mm. Like in Dublin, the Evening Herald are joking about the curfew. They ask, you know, will Father Christmas be able to get through the military barricades? But down in Cork, things feel different. You literally feel like you're under house arrest. And one local IRA volunteer says that 1,000 troops would pour out of Victoria Barracks at 10 p.m. every night and take over complete control of the city. So there's a suffocating atmosphere in Cork at the time, and it's not going to take much, if you will, for this to spill over.
I'm really tickled by the fact that the more things change, the more they stay the same, that even 100 years ago, people were wondering if Father Christmas would be able to get through the various circumstances of the day. Poetry just keeps repeating itself, doesn't it? The burnings,
yeah,
then...
And people were also shopping by post. People were also shopping by post in 1920 in a big way at Christmas and complaining about how long stuff took to arrive.
I'm sure there wasn't like an Amazon catalogue at the local P&T office, though. It was a slightly different kettle of fish back then. The burnings then that we're talking about here, the ultimate, the burning of Cork City itself, it all stems from an ambush, which by now is, of course, a well-established pattern of reprisal as well.
Yeah, generally speaking, there's an IRA ambush on the Oxys or the Tans, and there's a kind of a nearly immediate response generally against the civilian population. And what happens here in Cork, what triggers the burning of Cork, it's not actually a particularly large-scale ambush, but you know, I think the tensions have just grown so much that it's not going to take much to boil things over. Mm. Dillon's Cross, which is kind of near to the city of Cork, two lorry loads of Oxys are confronted by the IRA. Grenades hurled, and one of the Oxys dies as a result of his injuries. And the official report has it that 12 of them are wounded. That's not the most significant attack on the Oxys in Cork, even in recent weeks, you know, but it was enough, I think, to tip them over the edge psychologically. And the way that they respond at Dillon's Cross itself is really bizarre. Jerry White, Brendan O'Shea, who wrote a book years ago on the burning of Cork, they talk about a pub near the ambush site, which is raided. And this is just really bizarre behaviour. You know, young men being rounded up and forced to lie on the ground at the entrance of St. Mary's Avenue. One of them dragged to the centre of the crossroads, stripped naked, whipped repeatedly and forced to sing God Save the King until he collapsed on the road. That kind of behaviour for me, it kind of recalls those... deeply troubled young soldiers in place like Abu Ghraib, you know, during the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
It's like it's a psychological breakdown, if you will, and it comes from a bad place in terms of morale. And it's the kind of stuff that's really starting to trouble the upper echelons of the British military, you know, in London and in Dublin. But I think it also demonstrated just how frustrated the Oxys were becoming with the IRA, this kind of invisible army as they see them. I mean, one of the volunteers who was involved in that attack said, bloodhounds were used in the search, but for all their efforts to trace us failed. So what's increasingly happening is that they can't get the people who are actually attacking them. So thus the vengeance, if you will, is being reaped on people like those poor people at the pub in Dillon's Cross.
Yeah, but it's pretty grim stuff. I mean, it's one thing to be frustrated by how slippery or how sort of intangible your enemy is, but something like that is a totally different world apart altogether. You've dug up a quote from a journalist from the Cork Examiner at the time who had a great first-hand account of what happens then as the fire begins to take hold.
Yeah, journalists are basically among the only people that can move around, you know, under curfews in Cork and Dublin. And a journalist called Alan J. Ellis, who worked in the Cork Examiner, his account was republished in recent times. And it's brilliant because he captures, as only a journalist could capture, the mood in the city before this happens. You know, he says there was much activity in the city during the week before the big fire. Even the corporation believed that the events of that night were probably premeditated and was not an immediate reprisal action. By that weekend, the city had become almost used to the scattered and intermittent sound of gunfire. I like the way he sets the scene, you know, that people in Cork had a sense that something was coming, I think, in the weeks after Carmichael. But he talks about this just 9:30, he's walking through the city. He sees Fred Huston as the chief of the Cork Fire Brigade, and he writes about how I knew him slightly. He just arrived and was valiantly trying to organise his men. He told me bluntly that all the fires were being deliberately started by incendiary bombs, and in several cases he's seen soldiers pouring cans of petrol into buildings and setting them alight. Absolutely incredible wow. First-hand testimony. And you really do have to pity, you know, Huston, the chief of the Cork Fire Brigade, the way it comes across in that account. What could you do? Mm. Those who are meant to keep law and order are starting the flames.
It's just so stirring stuff. Like I'm almost impressed in one way that the language is so clear, because sometimes the reporting from times past can be a little bit more dressed up, or it can be a little bit more, you know, vernacular. It can be very much Queen's English. But the clarity of that, and also just the gravity of what's going on, that soldiers literally just, you know, pouring petrol into buildings and then setting fire to them. It's remarkable. And I suppose then, given all of that, there's really very little that the fire brigade were able to do about the massive infernos that were taking hold.
They lacked the modern kind of firefighting apparatus that, say, Dublin or Belfast would have had. They were still, like, largely horse-drawn. And actually, it's so bad for Cork Fire Brigade. They had to call on Dublin Fire Brigade to come down and help, and they do in the early hours of the following day. And I think there's something beautiful in that. I mean, that's the kind of thing that should be commemorated in the decade of centenaries. Mm. It's not just the military ambushes. I think there's a real quiet act of heroism in that story. You know, those Dublin firemen kind of rushing down to Cork. But, like, the Cork lads, the fire hoses are cut, so you can't really do anything. Firemen are basically pinned to the wall because they're under fire, unable to move. A number of them are injured. So they're totally helpless. And this thing begins at 9:30. And then by 4 a.m., hours into the violence, there's this awful, large explosion. City Hall and the neighbouring Carnegie Library just go up in flames. And I think for people in Cork, you know, that was like having their heart ripped from them, because City Hall was the symbol. You know, that's where McCartan had been mayor, McSweeney had been mayor. Mm. And even today, I mean, there's busts of McCartan and McSweeney outside City Hall, and it's McCartan and McSweeney that they wore on their jerseys this year. Yes, I mean, they are the symbol of revolutionary Cork. So this is a spectacular, and it's designed to be a spectacular, and it couldn't be ignored. But all the way through this in Cork, there's, you know, quietly in other places, there's dramatic things happening that night. People pulled off trams by the Oxies and attacked. Two brothers, the Delaney brothers, members of the IRA, shot in their homes at about 2 a.m. You can get away with all kinds of things on the margins, you know, when a city centre is burning, and they go largely unreported. So it's just a night of total chaos and score settling across Cork City.
Yeah, just because we mentioned it in the introduction, and you mentioned it there in passing again, just when we were talking about what the fire brigade could do. So their hoses were cut. Is it like that's by the Oxies as well? And
absolutely.
That the Oxies are shooting at the men who are trying to put out these fires.
So they're rendered, Cork Fire Brigade are essentially rendered totally useless, you know, on the ground. And despite the willingness of men to put themselves in the line of danger, a firefighter without a hose, you know, is little use in that kind of scenario. Yeah.
This is off the beaten track, but what exactly do you think an auxiliary force or anyone who's trying to, you know, they're there on the premise of trying to restore law and order, how exactly do they think they're going to achieve that by A, setting fire to the city, and then B, like firing at the innocent lads who are only trying to put out the fires again?
Yeah, I think the answer to that probably lies in a deep kind of psychological study of these young men, you know, and just the fact that they felt Ireland had been lost. And what survives, a really powerful letter survives from a young Oxie writing home to his mother after the event. Because I think when you're involved in something like, you know, this widespread arson of a city, there probably is a mad adrenaline rush that comes over young men doing these things. Mm. But then you go back to barracks and you really think about it, you know, and he writes to his mother, "In all my life, I've never experienced such orgies of murder, arson and looting as I've witnessed during the past 16 days with the RIC." And the people who are, you know, meant to defend these men politically in the House of Commons, like Hammer Greenwood, for example, the line is just extraordinary. Hammer Greenwood basically stands up in the House of Commons and says, "Oh no, the fires were started by the citizens of Cork. They've gone around blowing up and destroying their own city." And he says that the Crown forces were deployed to save Cork from absolute destruction. So they no longer even believe what they're saying in the House of Commons. And Hammer Greenwood could have stood up and said that the sky was purple. I mean, everything Hammer Greenwood says at that point in time is more or less a lie. And it's worth saying, many of the businesses that are destroyed, you know, the property owning class, the business owning class of the day, are kind of disproportionately unionist. So it's not just that nationalist property is destroyed. You know, orange and green capital alike, if you will, goes up in flames in Cork.
Which I'm sure then is possibly then sets the scene. It again sort of changes minds where people think that the Crown Forces might be going over there to restore a bit of order, that maybe it changes their minds afterwards. Amidst all the horror, though, there is one touching story of solidarity being expressed from people around the world with the people of Cork.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very tough one in terms of, like, the story here is very dark. It's very negative. But then there's this beautiful moment in its aftermath, which I think is very, very touching. I think it's maybe one of the most kind of touching stories of solidarity with the people of Ireland during the War of Independence. You know, you have this destroyed library, and there's nothing as tragic as there anywhere in the world as the sight of burnt books or a destroyed library. Mm. So books are donated from right across the world to Cork. The French embassy in Dublin, contemporary authors, including in Britain, you know, send their books to Cork signed, and the Irish diaspora in the United States really kind of rally behind the idea of filling the Carnegie Library in Cork again. So I think there's something beautiful about that, you know, and the fact that the Carnegie Library, you know, like a phoenix, reemerged from the ashes, and that City Hall is there again, with McSweeney and McCurtain outside of it. There's something very powerful in how Cork rebuilt itself. But certainly, you know, she could never be quite the same again. And I think it was one of the most traumatic nights of the War of Independence, definitely for the civilian population of Cork.
Yeah, there's a kind of a touching symmetry as well, but the fact that the Carnegie Libraries dotted all across Ireland were themselves the result of philanthropy as well by that major benefactor who built them all as well, Mr. Carnegie himself, and that it was all repopulated afterwards. Fascinating stuff. That's the burning of Cork, which took place a century ago this week, as summarised brilliantly and so regularly, in fact, on this slot by Donald Fallon, who is an author. He's a historian. He is the author of the Come Here To Me books, and he's the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast, which you'll find online. Donald, as ever, thank you very much.